So what we have worked on is how do we find a way to express the demand for data and a definition of the problem better so that we actually can align data, especially what we call minimum viable data, in a better way so that we don't need all the data. You just need the data to answer the question that matters. And that's where we have tried to innovate a new kind of questioning. And I've been advocating that we not only need data science, we also need question science. We actually need to become much smarter on what are the questions that matter that we then can answer with data.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a very interesting conversation with Stefan van Holst, co-founder of the Gulp Lab, whose mission it is to transform the way people make decisions through new technologies and science. We begin by Stefan telling us about his background in communications and information technology, his passion for making sense of the world through storytelling and narratives, and how these can frame reality and ultimately affect decision making. Stefan then tells us how he co-founded the Gulp Lab and shares a bit about the work that they do before sharing with us what a smart community is to him. We talk more about how the Gulp Lab connects in with smart communities and some of the challenges Stefan has faced in the data collaboration world. We then discuss how social media affects the way people make decisions and how artificial intelligence can complement collective intelligence. We discuss the emerging trends of a broader demand for meaningful public engagement, the adoption of public entrepreneurship, and better data collaboration. We finish our chat discussing the importance of understanding the right questions to ask when analyzing data. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Stefan. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you so much, Zoe, for having me.
No, I'm so excited to have you. Let's just jump straight in. Can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Sure. Again, thanks for having me. And so as to background, I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. As you might hear from my accent, I initially grew up in Belgium and then subsequently left Belgium to, go via Scotland and Oxford and ended up here in New York City. But I think my background has always been somewhat related with how we ultimately go about making sense of the world. And initially, my first passion was really around how storytelling and narratives are making sense of the world. So I initially started off into film and filmmaking, but then ended up in actually the whole issue of communications and information technology, and specifically on how through new technologies, we actually have different ways of frame reality and making sense of reality. And so that made me end up in Glasgow, where I was part of a center and helped set up a center to really think about how mediation frames reality and how we actually can or should regulate the way reality is portrayed. And then ended up in Oxford, where I co-founded a center around communications, law, and policy, which is really focused on how ultimately we make sense of the world through the data and the information that is being provided to us, and what is the responsibility to make sure that that is portrayed in a somewhat objective, but at least pluralistic way. And so we were tasked at that time to really develop a whole range of media frameworks, quite often in conflict zones, such as Bosnia, East Timor, Rwanda, for that matter, where the use of communications really framed the issues that led to violence. Anyway, long-winded story to then ultimately say is that I ended up in New York, where I was head of research of a private foundation whose main focus was on how to use information and information technology to address critical public needs. And so we focused on how can information technology address the way we provide healthcare so that we ultimately have actually a better sense of understanding what works and what does not work in the medical profession, because you might be surprised that to a large extent, medicine is still not that much understood, i.e. we actually quite often still don't know what actually works for a particular kind of individual, right? And so there we developed a whole range of initiatives around health information sharing. And then we did the same thing in around education, around development. How can we make development more data-driven and more led by evidence? And then subsequently, a few years ago, I came to the realization that we can come up with the best solutions, but if we don't find a way to transform the way we make decisions based upon a better understanding of reality and having a baseline of reality, we will never be able to actually be able to tackle the hard problems. And so that's when I co-founded GovLab, which is Governance Laboratory. And so we are based here in New York, and part of the Engineering School of New York University. And the mission is indeed to look into how do we transform the way we make decisions, leveraging new technologies and new science. And specifically, so that has meant that we have looked into two assets, as we call them, that can be applied using technology in new ways. And on the one hand, that involves people and people as asset of knowledge. And how can we tap into that supply of expertise in order to really understand what is the current situation, what are the root causes of certain kinds of problems, and what might be some of the solutions that are unknown unless you actually have experiential experience. And that's the people side. And so quite often we call that collective intelligence. And then the other side is data. And so here we've been focusing a lot on how do we unlock data to actually get a better sense of what is the current situation, what are the needs, and how do we go about perhaps predicting what might happen moving forward, and how does that translate into better decisions as it relates to solving public problems. So that's probably more than you asked for, Zoe, but that's perhaps in a nutshell what the trajectory. And see, there is no clear line there, but at least there is some commonality with regard to at least trying to understand how we frame problems, how we frame reality. And initially, that was through storytelling, but then eventually it was more through actually using data and people's expertise.
Mm. And I guess that storytelling element still weaves its way through the whole thing, right? Because like you said, when we make, it's not just the data or, you know, the, oh, we found this great thing out. It's how does that change the decision-making process, which is through storytelling, whatever people want to call it. But yeah, I think that's super interesting. And just framing and even talking about reality as something that we need to frame and that it's different and that we can bring. Yeah, I find that really, really fascinating.
Yeah, and it's experienced by different people differently, right? So I think that's the... Anyway, and I don't want to go and elaborate on that too much, but I think it is important to understand that depending on how you frame and depending on your frame of reference, right, you will have a different experience. And this whole discussion these days about misinformation is quite often an attempt to change the frame of reality, right? And then subsequently, actually kind of pollute the common understanding of what it is that we collectively agree the baseline is, right? And I think that's problematic, obviously, but that's also where data can be actually misused, but also, anyway, obviously, it can also be used in a better way to actually really test and also rectify certain kinds of assumptions, because we all enter the world with a set of assumptions, and how do we know whether those assumptions are actually real, right? And I think that's, from my point of view, a key element in actually a more data-driven decision-making is to really also test those assumptions in a way. But then you rightly so we to then take the insight and turn it into decision, right? And quite often we call that from data intelligence to decision intelligence, right? And that's quite often where this translational aspect comes into play, which, by the way, from my point of view, we actually have not really become that sophisticated. That's also where then, from my point of view, additional storytelling is necessary to really then frame it, why it matters, what are the experiences, what are some of the, anyway, lived effects that will happen from certain kinds of decisions. And that's, I think, how we need to become more sophisticated to take storytelling plus data plus values into account when we make decisions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. I think let's zoom up a bit. I just want to ask you one question about smart communities and then let's dive back down again. So what is a smart community to you?
Well, a smart community, anyway, has multiple layers, of course. But one, it's, of course, a way to actually identify knowledge within a community and then connect that with demands for knowledge and demands for insight to improve community's well-being, right? And I think a smart community is actually a community that knows who knows what and then really finds a way to connect that with the demands that might be in society. And that could be diverse, but unfortunately, we are actually really bad as a society to really understand who knows what or and then who knows what. Again, I mean that in terms of different types of expertise, right? So this could be expertise in terms of exactly credentialed expertise, but that's only one type of expertise. It could also be lived experience or it could be just pure interest, right? And so having a better understanding of that and then being able to connect that with specific needs, that's how a smart community translates the collective intelligence that they have into a more manifest application to making the community better. So that's one way that you can understand smart community. Now, of course, on top of that, you can also have then a more smarter way to monitor the communities and the environment in which you are operating. And that's where then, of course, additional tools such as sensors enables an understanding of actually the environment in which a community operates or the needs that a community might have, right? So then you have an additional layer of a smart community, which is actually a community that understands the situation in which that community operates, where the needs are, what are the, anyway, the baselines with, anyway, transportation, for instance, challenges or skills that are existing in a society and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like that. And I think you're right. I mean, it's so layered and we still, I think the definition is not as important as what we want to actually do with it, what we want to achieve with it. And I think data is a huge part of that, obviously. So that's a very obvious thing to say. But I think sometimes we talk about technology a lot, but not actually the data to make the decisions. You know, when you're putting the sensor out there or whatever, what are you doing with that? Let's go back to the Gov Lab. You've given us a little bit of insight on what you do, but what are some of your key, I guess, activities that really fit into the smart community space?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, as I said, in a very simplistic way, we have two ways to connect it with the smart communities and then subsequently two range of projects. On the one hand is around people, right? So here we do a lot of work around, like, for instance, people-led innovation, where we look into how do we engage people in new ways. And by people, we understand a broad range of segments of people, right? So this could be in a city, for instance, it could be residents, but it could also be business owners, or it could also be community leaders, or it could also be commuters who might have a different kind of perspective of the city and give a different kind of experience, right? So I think that's one part of what we do is really this kind of people-led innovation approach by which we look into how can we co-create approaches to developing solutions across the solution life cycle, ranging from co-creating the agenda for change, right? And that's something where we've done a lot of work on, which is really trying to understand how do we actually do participatory agenda setting, to then ultimately co-creating solutions and co-creating evaluations of whether things work, right? So that's like one kind and set of initiatives. We have a whole range of so-called city challenges, where we anyway try to then ideate about solutions by tapping into the expertise and the talent that resides within cities, so that you connect the talent with the demand and then ultimately come up with more legitimate solutions. So that's one kind of projects. The other one is clearly data. And so there, what we have done is really trying to think about how do we unlock data that has been collected for one purpose within a city, for instance. How can we unlock that and use it for another purpose? And I think that has been the biggest challenge, Zoe, in the data space. I mean, quite often we get really concerned about collection, which I think we should be probably for sure. But from my point of view, collection is one challenge. The other big challenge in the current data age is how do we actually use the data that is being collected in a way that actually improves people's lives? And that means that we're going to have to come up with new structures, new models, new governance approaches to reuse data and provide access to data that was collected for one purpose for another purpose. And we call that data collaboration, because guess what? The data that you need, quite often you don't have, and is being collected by someone else. And so you're going to have to come up with new kinds of public-private partnerships where you really tap into data that others have in order to start answering questions that you have. We call that also, within the city context, we quite often call that circular city data, i.e. data that was collected in the city for one purpose, and this could be for transaction purposes, right? Think could be if you go to a supermarket, data is being collected in order to enable the transaction. Well, how can we use that for other purposes in the city so that it also enables a better governance and management of the city? For instance, how do we understand where food deserts are? How do we understand what consumption of certain kinds of products might lead to child obesity, for instance, in a city? And so there are a whole range of use cases where you can repurpose data collected within the city for other purposes. And that's what we have tried to figure out. It turns out not to be easy because there are all kinds of constraints. But I think as a society, that's if we really want to move into a smart community where data drives decision making, we will have to come up with solutions where we repurpose data instead of always collecting more data, which turns out to be quite often not as useful as data that is already being collected.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And I guess like this, that would be very, it's a very challenging task. And there's also, you know, a whole bunch of, I guess, you know, privacy, security, ethical issues as well. What are some of your biggest challenges that you're facing in that data collaboration world?
All right, now you get me going, Zoe. But the Well, just to deconstruct it a little bit. Well, the biggest challenge is how do we do this in a systematic, sustainable, and responsible way? By which I mean systematic, too often this is done in a pilot, right? Or in an ad hoc way, and then it never scales and it never survives. Sustainable, we're talking about using data as a public good. Surprise, surprise, we have not figured out how to actually fund data as a public good. Right. And then thirdly, responsible. And you refer to indeed the concerns that exist from an ethical point of view. How do we make sure that this doesn't harm people more than it benefits? And more importantly, how do we also deal with both individual and collective rights that are associated with data? So these are some of the challenges. Now, you could anyway deconstruct it even further and say, well, part of the challenge is that we actually don't really have expressed the demand for data well enough, right? Because too often it's like they start with the data, right? Say, oh, look what we can do with the data. And surprise, surprise, you come up with a lot of interesting insights, quite often, unfortunately, very marginal and quite often very problematic because you actually did a lot of data mining without really a purpose in mind. And as a result, you could actually have violated a whole set of privacy concerns without purpose. So what we have worked on is how do we find a way to express the demand for data and a definition of the problem better so that we actually can align data, especially what we call minimum viable data, in a better way so that we don't need all the data. You just need the data to answer the question that matters. And that's where we have tried to innovate a new kind of questioning. And I've been advocating that we not only need data science, we also need question science. We actually need to become much smarter on what are the questions that matter that we then can answer with data. And so here we have an initiative which we've called the 100 Questions Initiative, which comes from my frustration that most people are focusing on 100 data sets, but never manage to formulate the 100 questions that matter for a city, for instance. And so what we are advocating for is that if you are a city and you want to become a smart city, start with 100 questions that matter to your city and then organize your smart city to start making progress on actually getting answers. Otherwise, what's the purpose of having a smart city if you don't really can formulate what are the areas that matter to the communities? And so we do that in a participatory way. Again, I can spend the next hour sharing the lessons learned, but I think it comes down to really engaging with the communities and engaging with what we call bilinguals, which are people that have a domain expertise and a data expertise and can really understand what is it that matters and what can be answered by data. So that's the first, just the demand side. Then the other part, Zoe, is to really professionalizing the supply side. And what by which we mean is that we need a new profession within the supply side that can actually engage on repurposing their data for other public interest objectives. Because without that new profession, it's going to be very hard to make this more systematic. We get loads of people knocking on my door because they happen to know that we do a lot of work with the private sector and with other, including government data holders. And they always ask me, Stefan, who should I talk to in corporation or in government X and or Y with regard to their data if I want to have access to their data? And Zoe, most of the time I have to say, good luck finding out. Because there is no well-defined profession within the data holders that have a mandate to really respond to solicitations for their data to use it for other purposes. And so we call that the absence of chief data stewards. And so we have been working on creating this new profession of data stewardship that really is different than data officers, for instance, because their mission is not to maximize the use of data for internal objectives. It's really thinking about how can we maximize the use of our data for society at large. And that's another challenge that we could have addressed. And then, of course, once you have a supply that is professionalized and once you have a clear defined demand, how do you match it then, right? And that's then where you need to come up with new operational models, new governance models, new technical structures to actually provide access. Sometimes we're not talking about sharing, but about access to data. And that's where we need a more methodological way of doing this. It's most cases, everyone has to invent as they go along. Well, it turns out, anyway, we actually have learned a lot on how to do this, right? So we need a new methodological way of actually setting up data collaboratives. And that includes also a way to actually shape data sharing agreements, because, and that, they're going to end there. It's not, anyway, you could come up with the best demand. You could have a really good supply side, but then of course the lawyers arrive and then it becomes complicated to think about how do you actually turn this into a data sharing agreement. And so we've done a lot of work on also demystifying those kinds of agreements and more streamlining them as such. So these are some of the challenges. And I will end with one more. And then you will have like a fuller picture. The last challenge is really what we call the challenge of how do you get a social license to do all of this, right? Because if we talk about repurposing data that was collected for one purpose for another purpose, then you do need to go beyond consent, which is typically a complicated concept and quite often a flawed concept anyhow. And so you really need to think about how do we actually get a renewed social license to do this? And that's where you need to have an ongoing deliberation with citizens around what they feel is appropriate, what they feel would be the right conditions, and also what are their expectations. And so what we have been pioneering is so-called data assemblies, which we call citizens assemblies around the reuse of data. And I think that's another element that we need to advance so that we actually get that social license, which will in turn provide for trust in how all of this has happened. But absent that kind of extra deliberation and engagement, consent is not going to provide the level of trust that you need in order to really repurpose that for other objectives. So there you go, Zoe. perhaps too much again, but these are just a few areas that we've been working on.
Yeah, no, super interesting. And I think, yeah, talking about the social license to round that out is really, really key. And then how we then, yeah, extend beyond our traditional, I guess, in the data sphere or smart community sphere, but moving beyond that and gaining that social license is really key. And I think a tricky thing too, particularly if there's distrust in the government, you know, which is a global phenomenon, but also then understanding how it's being used, as in how it would affect me as an individual, and maybe it won't because it's anonymized or whatever the case may be. But I think that's something that's really important. And particularly in smart communities, talk a lot about being informed and empowered, and doesn't mean you have to know absolutely everything, but you know where to go to get the information, which is what you talked about earlier, which I really, really, I hadn't thought about it. I kind of thought about it like that, but the way you articulated, yeah, really made sense to me, which I think is really something that we probably don't talk about enough. It's the information element of smart communities and data and all these things that we're trying to do. If it's just a pilot or if it's just a this or a that, and go, oh yes, I got something great out of that. But if you can't scale it, like you were talking about some of those challenges, then overall it won't make a huge difference.
No, it will be another shiny object, but not really something that is transformative, right? And so I think it's really about what is the potential here to be transformative. And ultimately, anyway, as I said, we are not in it just for the data. It's really about how do we transform the way we make decisions, right? I.e. making it more legitimate and effective at the same time, because that turns out to be the real challenge, is that it could be very legitimate but not effective. It could be very effective but not legitimate. How do you become legitimate and effective at the same time? And I think data has a role to play there, but again, only when it is actually being used in a legitimate manner, right? And I think that's the real challenge here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, decisions are being made, and I've said this on the podcast a number of times, you know, decisions are being made right now with a lack of data or, you know, different data or whatever. So the decisions still need to be made, but if we can use data to make them better for, you know, the collective, I think that will be one of those key, I guess, pillars within a smart community where we can go, oh, yes, okay, now we're actually, this decision may be different, but it's because it's now on more, you know, more accurate data or whatever the case may be. But of course, yeah, like you were talking about earlier, the ethical, making sure we're not causing harm.
Exactly. So anyway, and again, we're doing a lot of work, and what I really want to do next is really, anyway, developing more insight with regard to decision intelligence. But at the core, so decisions is really about choosing between options in a context of uncertainty, right? Right. And so there are always a few ways of going about a particular kind of problem or a particular kind of way of doing things, providing a service, for instance. And so how do we become smarter about, anyway, choosing, and how do we take the level of uncertainty or lower the level of uncertainty on what works, what is the impact and that kind of stuff, right? And I think that's, anyway, that's where data plays a role, right? Because data, to a large extent, again, there's a lot of hype about it, but to a large extent, it can do a few things. And that's basically providing additional insight, right? That can inform and take away some of the level of uncertainties and provide better insight with regard to the options to be taken, given the situation that one is operating in. And so there's no magic there. But I think if you deconstruct it that way, then it makes sense on what the value proposition is. But it also doesn't provide more than that. So we shouldn't hype it either, right? But you still need to understand how it can be used.
Now, I want to go to emerging trends, but I first want to ask you about social media and how that has affected, like, you've been in this game a little while now, and you would have seen, been looking at decision-making and data and sentiment and all those type of things before social media became a thing. How has it changed the way that maybe we make decisions?
Oh, well, yeah, no, radically, right? So, well, I think the two big factors of social media, or you could call it three, right, that have changed decision-making are related with A, the always-on mentality, right? So social media never has a break, right? It's always on. And as a result, like in the past, anyway, you had a period between news cycles, for instance, right? Now there is no news, no period or pause between news cycles. It's an always on news cycle. And that, of course, has changed the way, from a political point of view, changed the way you go about communicating and making decisions, right? Because everything is almost like instantly produced. And the other element is, of course, that we have less of that kind of mediation. And so everything is now being broadcast as well, right? So in the past, we had some mediation, by which I meant there was at least a gatekeeper that, and for good and for bad. But now, anyway, there are no gatekeepers anymore, and everyone is now a communicator and a broadcaster. And that also has radically transformed, because who do you trust, right? And who do you, who has actually the facts, for instance, that should be trusted these days, right? So obviously we still have traditional media, but given the fact that everyone now is a broadcaster, everyone is now disseminating different facts, and quite often, of course, misinformed or half truths or lies, right? So those, I think, are two important elements. Now, at the same time, social media also allows you to really get smarter about actually sentiments and really be able to tap into what is actually the current mood with regard to a particular kind of topic. So it's not only negative in the sense of having a much harder time to break through the information glut and also make decisions almost in an ongoing real-time environment without moments of reflection. You also can actually use social media to become smarter about the signal that is out there. There's a lot of noise, but there's also a signal. And if you can find a way to extract it, that might actually improve your decision-making as well.
Yeah, really interesting. I've been listening to a couple of podcasts, speaking of, you know, people broadcasting on podcasts, but about, yeah, I guess falling down rabbit holes and things. The algorithm was about YouTube, then showing you new content, watch time, et cetera, and then how the algorithm changed, and then that can pick you up out of a rabbit hole, but actually can just shift you down another one that may be not as dangerous or maybe equally as dangerous, but on the other side of the fence. And yeah, just interesting. And I think we talk a lot about the algorithm, but we don't really understand what that means. And having more and more people involved from the people side of things, I think, is really important. So then we can actually bring that human element in there, because as much as big tech is talking about, oh, we've got humans doing things, we've got tech people doing things, which you were talking about earlier, that translator with the domain expertise, or to translate bilingual, so the domain expertise. Yeah, I think we need to see more and more of them, which means we need more and more different types of people coming into the tech industry or into the smart community, whatever we're going to call it, the data. And I think that will hopefully we'll see a shift, but it won't be by accident. I think we need some
very radical change without using radical in, I do say radical quite a lot, but not that radical sense of danger, but yeah, a really big leap in how we do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've written about that as well, where I make the point that we really have to think about how collective intelligence and artificial intelligence are supporting each other, right? And so collective intelligence, like citizens engagement or smart crowdsourcing for that matter, has huge transaction costs and is quite often very noisy. And so artificial intelligence actually can augment collective intelligence, right? If you find a way to identify, for instance, the signal, like for instance, cities are quite often doing massive public consultations. Now, guess what, Zoe? Most of the time, no one can figure out what actually the signal is of all those consultations, right? Because if 100,000 people are submitting their opinion, good luck finding some kind of a signal there. And so their artificial intelligence can actually help with augmenting the collective intelligence. But then vice versa as well, what you said is that we need actually also more human judgment in how then artificial intelligence is making sense. And I think that's where what I call human-driven artificial intelligence, where we need that kind of human judgment in order to really monitor the quite often the misalignment between what goes in and what goes out, right? Because that's the biggest challenge with artificial intelligence is the misalignment that is happening as a result of how algorithms or training data is being designed. And I think that's where you still need some kind of a human judgment to a large extent. And so that's where I think, anyway, so CI and AI, when you combine them, they have actually more potential than if you separate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, I know we're running out of time, so let's jump to the future.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's been great conversation, but I know that you have to finish your day. I'm just starting mine here in Australia. But let's jump to the future. And can we talk about the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Yeah, well, I think emerging trends, one is really where we will see a broader demand for public engagement, right? So I think we've been doing a lot of talk about deliberative democracy and so on, but I think people really are ready for a new way of actually deliberation. And I think that's going to be interesting to see how that will be sustained. And also, more importantly, how you can actually scale it and make it meaningful. Because too often we see a lot of public engagement for the sake of public engagement without actually translating it into some kind of meaningful input. So that's one area. The other area, I think, is where we really are going to see changes in the public sector, where I know that your podcast is a lot about entrepreneurship, but I do think that we're going to see more adoption of what we call public entrepreneurship, where you actually will have the public sector adopt practices that are more akin to an entrepreneurship, where you experiment with approaches, where you use design thinking and data in order to really figure out what works, when, where, and for whom, right? And so that's a trend that hopefully we will see more of, but at least is already emerging in a variety of areas. And it actually goes beyond the previous trend, what people got excited about, which is social innovation. But here it's more embedded in actually methodologies of entrepreneurship, from my point of view. And then obviously, we'll see more trends as it relates to data. And I think the real opportunity will be data collaboratives around particular kind of questions and missions, as opposed to, for instance, what you have quite now, which is really, on the one hand, open data, where things get put on a portal without really a clear sense of purpose quite often, right? And again, these are really important and valuable efforts. But I think the impact has been limited because it hasn't been matched to the demand or with a particular kind of mission. And the other one is closed, right, where you actually have no access. And I think we will see new ways of accessing data for a clear mission. And that kind of data collaboration is really happening now, and which will lead and will be driven by a new notion of corporate social responsibility as well. Because I do believe, and I've written about that as well, that the new corporate social responsibility at the data age is really about how do we use the data that we have in a way that can improve people's lives. And I think more and more corporations will be called upon to actually develop that line of responsibility, because typically responsibility in the current era means protecting. That will remain important, but will also be, have you used it in a manner that actually improved people's lives? So it's also not just about the misuse, but also about the missed uses of data that will be central moving forward. So that's a few trends. to perhaps give an indication on how we could get there. Obviously, in order to really ride those waves, we do have to invest in a variety of things. But I see, anyway, that many, including in Australia, many efforts are pointing towards those directions. And I think there is a real potential to, anyway, actually making those changes.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, yeah, really interesting and really link back to that 100 questions, which I really liked, and something I'm doing a data science degree at the moment and something I think about quite a lot. And I think asking those 100 questions is something of a city, or even if it's, yeah, just working out that question, I don't think there's enough focus on the logic of, well, why are you looking at this data set? Why do we need this? What decisions are going to be made with this, or what insights can we find? And I think that you'll find other things, and that's great. But actually going in with that question, which I suppose is a very, you know, research question, but yeah.
Well, it's me. And again, there are different, first of all, I think people quite often don't understand what are the types of questions, right? And again, this is data science 101, right? So there are, anyway, a few set of questions. And so even having a taxonomy of questions, and they are not all research questions, right? They are, anyway, in essence, anyway, the question is, what do you find research, right? But anyway, there are questions related with understanding the current situation, right? Which is how I started, trying to get sense of what is reality now, trying to understand how is it that we are in the current situation. So those cause and effect kind of questions, understanding, well, how will it eventually evolve, right? Prediction. And then ultimately, if we do X, does it actually change things, right? So some kind of impact questions. And so these are the four basic questions that, and of course, anyway, with different levels of sophistication, but if you can say, well, these are the four types of questions where data can start answering, then you can actually inform policymakers, do you actually have a baseline with regard to the problem? Well, perhaps you should do better situation analysis. Do you actually understand how it is that we in that situation? Perhaps you should actually combine some data sets to understand, anyway, root causes, right? And so that's all, from my point of view, related with formulating the questions. And then obviously data science plays a key role. But if we don't have the capacity and the understanding on what are the kinds of questions that matter, right, to then make progress, data will have not that much value, and it will actually create quite often more harm and potential danger than needed.
When you're trying to apply the wrong data, or, you know, different, trying to create, not even create, but trying to identify cause and effect where there isn't one, etc.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of correlations, right, that are not causations, right? So, but yeah, now we could go on forever.
We could. Okay. Well, Stefan, it's been so great to have you on the podcast. I think we could talk for a long, long time. And thank you for, joining me all the way from New York City. Just one last question. How can people connect with you?
Well, they can connect me via the GovLab. I would say that's probably the easiest. I'm not really active on Twitter, but you can go to @thegovlab, or I'm more active on LinkedIn, where you can just search for Stefan Verhulst. And of course, that's also a way where you can then identify my email address, I guess, as well. But that's might be the best way forward.
Sounds good. We will put the link in the links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. Again, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you, Zoe. Take care. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye. You too. Bye.
Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.